Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses for an audience of entrepreneurs like today's guest. Today's guest is somebody who would listen to Mixergy interviews as he was building up his company and is back here to talk about how he did it. I asked him why. He said, well, I got a lot out of the interviews myself, and I want to tell people, I want to tell other entrepreneurs my story, and hopefully they'll get something out of it. And I know they will. And today's guest founded software that you have no doubt used a bunch, and maybe you didn't know about the company behind it, and maybe you didn't know about the person behind the company. His name is George Deglin. He is the founder of OneSignal. If you've ever been on a website where you'll see an alert that says, hey, do you want to get alerts when we update the site, when there's changes to what we do, and you hit yes, accept, there's a good chance that OneSignal was the company that powered that. Now, I've known them always as the company that does these website alerts, these website re-engagement campaigns for free, but they go beyond that. OneSignal makes it really easy for companies of all sizes to re-engage users across all messaging channels. So it goes beyond that. In fact, the original inspiration wasn't even Chrome reminders, but iOS, iPhone alerts, and Android alerts. We'll find out how he built this business by solving his own problem, his own pain, and then now helping so many other websites. Thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first, if you're building a website, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. The second, when you're ready to hire developers, oh, I saw on your LinkedIn profile that you guys are still hiring. You should be checking out TopTal, but I'll talk to you and everyone else about them later on. First, George, is there a company that you saw use OneSignal that made you feel like, yeah, this is great that I get to create something that's associated with that brand?
Oh gosh, so many. I think the thing that really excited me early on was to see game studios adopting OneSignal. And I don't know if I can mention some of them, but yeah, that was certainly a highlight. I think another one was when HQ Trivia was really, really popular. And I think I was hooked on it along with, it seemed like half the people in the world. They were a customer of ours. So it was super exciting to see that lead come in. And
that's a big one, because with HQ Trivia, you had to show up at the exact time that the game show started on your phone, and there would be 1 million, 2 million people at the same time all watching and competing against each other. And those alerts would have to fire without a delay, right? If you just are 5 minutes late, forget it. People are upset because they missed their chance to win the prize at that competition. How much revenue are you guys doing?
We recently raised a Series B, and I would say we've performed very, very well since then. So while I can't say exactly where we are from a revenue standpoint,
can you give me a ballpark? Are we talking about the 1 to 5 million, 5 to even 15? Any kind of range would give me a sense of how big you guys are.
Yeah, the 5 to 15 is probably a closer range for us.
Okay. All right. And you raised money, I saw, from Justin Kahn. Am I right?
Yeah.
Y Combinator. Mm-hmm. Rakuten, the famous, well, it's not so famous. They want to be more well-known in the U.S., even though a lot of us are interacting with their e-commerce software. They are the Japanese Amazon, I think, is the way that they've been described. But that's not the best description. It's just the best way of communicating. I feel like, though, your first big success, and we'll get into how you did this, but it feels like your first big success happened, your first shot out of the gate with Uversity. Am I right?
Yeah, if you can call it a bit of a success. I think one really exciting part of it, so Uversity was the first company that I co-founded. And I actually dropped out of school to start running that business after we raised venture capital. So it was cool to be able to dive into the full-time workforce, being the founder of a venture-backed startup. And really an exciting journey. Lots of really positive times. Also some hard times. We went through the financial crisis with that company and survived it.
You started just before the financial crisis, 2007, yep. Right? Were you a guy who always wanted to be an entrepreneur so that it wasn't such a strange experience for you to have started in the work world as a CEO or CTO?
Yeah, absolutely. I was itching, yeah.
Tell me, let's go back a little further. What was your childhood entrepreneurial experience like, if you had any?
Yeah, definitely. So both my parents were engineers, so that really inspired my interest in computers and programming. And going even back a little further than that, my mom had been one of the first business owners in Russia after private individuals were allowed to start companies. So she was very business-minded in a much more difficult business climate than we have here even.
What was the business that she had?
So it was a consulting company, helped with construction projects and a few other things like that.
Consulting company. Okay. And then why'd she leave if she was already an entrepreneur there?
Yeah, I mean, mainly to make a better life here in the United States.
Was there a family story that you guys tell about one difficult thing in Russia that made you guys want to leave?
I mean, there's countless stories, like living in Russia at the time, you know, when we came over early 1990s was definitely like not easy. The country like had a lot of things that made building a business or like being successful there, getting good education was just all very, very challenging. And in contrast, I mean, I think it's true in the United States, you can come here and through like working hard and all of that, you can really build an amazing life for yourself. And I think that is certainly proven true for us.
You know, I had a friend, I was just telling my kids about this on the hike. I tell them stories while we hike to get them to keep on going. And I told them about this friend who in elementary school, everyone thought was really weird until he stood up. And since we were talking about Russia, he said, I lived in Russia and I escaped. And that's why I have this accent that you guys all think is funny. And then he started talking about his experience there. He said, I used to call people names, and the name that everyone called each other if they were really like looking to be insulting was Jew. And he said, I didn't know until later on that we were Jewish because my parents were trying to shield me from it. And I didn't realize that my parents were really uptight because they had mics in our house. And then we got to escape. And as he told his story in a way that was more childlike than I just expressed it, but also more pain than I could ever communicate, I think a lot of us just changed our opinion of him completely. Do you guys have any of those types of stories? Obviously not that bad, but was there any one incident that defined your experience there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty familiar story to me. So
really?
My family's Jewish.
You are. Did they know that you were Jewish? Was there persecution for being Jewish? Was it just like an insult the way some people used to call people gay in the US?
There is definitely like religious oppression in Russia. And yeah, I think that certainly in like early 1990s was more severe.
What about the mics? Were there mics in your house too, or was this an unusual experience?
I haven't heard anything about that. But you know, to be honest, like we moved here, I was like just 4 and a half, and I think my parents have shielded me from a lot of what they had to experience. So who knows? I'm sure that they went through some rough times.
So coming to the land of entrepreneurship and business, what are some of the little businesses you had when you were growing up?
Oh gosh, there were a lot of little things I was doing. I ran a server for like a massive multiplayer online game for a while. And I had like admins that I like recruited as volunteers and things like that. I ran a personal forum just for like my friends and myself. And it got up to a couple hundred members. So that was cool.
How old were you when you started that first one? You know what it is? I know that it's MMO, but I feel like such a fraud even talking about it, having never played it, you know, and I'm always worried, am I going to be called out for not being a gamer, not being in this? How old were you when you did that?
I don't remember exactly. I was probably like 14, would be my
age. Okay. Wow. All right. So not super unusual that you'd be able to get a group of friends together, start this business. What was the catalyst for creating Uversity when you were in school?
Yeah, I mean, a big one, I was just fascinated by education technology itself. And it was through my own experiences. Like the software that students have to use every day tends to be pretty abysmal in quality. And as a student that knew how to code and built side projects and things like that, it was painful to use something every day that was, you know, seemed like I could do so much better, right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, what led to me co-founding Uversity is I actually met my co-founder, who had an idea, had already started to dabble in it, had good relationships with Silicon Valley, and it was an opportunity to just like jump onto to something that was starting to get off the ground.
And so the idea was to create a better version of what already existed in school.
Of sorts, yeah. I mean, EdTech itself was a space I was interested in, and then you know, my co-founder had this vision, which was to build a social network for students. And, you know, the timing of this, so Facebook had just started to become a big thing. And also Facebook had just released the Facebook platform. Mm-hmm. And so also Facebook was starting to switch away from being a very school-focused social network to being just kind of focused on everyone in the world. And so there was an interesting opportunity to build something on the Facebook platform, which is what we did. and bring students together. You know, all of us were like in school or just out of school. So we were very familiar with kind of what students were looking for.
What was the first version? What did it look like?
So it was very simple. You would add the app. It was a Facebook app. It was very integrated into Facebook. And you would pick the school that you attended. It could be high school or college. And you put in all the courses that you were taking. And then it would tell you who else was in those courses with you.
Okay. That's super simple.
Yeah, pretty simple.
Okay. And so it was on you now to go and recruit students for this.
Yeah.
At your school, I'm assuming first?
Not really. I mean, there were a couple places where we were able to get early adoption. And one was just through the Facebook app, like listing. So there was a bit of organic market share. And then Facebook also provided tools that apps were able to use to get some viral spread. So when people would take action, this would get shared in their newsfeed, and then that would bring their classmates and friends onto it. And so we were leveraging a lot of that for growth, and quite successfully, actually.
One of the things that they would do is as soon as somebody added an app, they would say, here are all your friends. Right. Select the ones that you want to tell about this app and bring them into the app.
Yeah.
And people would, because of the flow, end up telling all their friends.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, in the very first version of Facebook platform, you didn't even have to ask the user to select what friends they wanted to tell. You could actually just send API calls without the user permission, and then all their friends would get invited.
Wow.
I think one of the interesting things about the Facebook platform at the time is nobody really knew what was possible. And so these sort of, you could certainly use that to drive an insane amount of growth in kind of like malicious ways. And some apps did that. In our case, we were trying to really like be good at providing good user experience. So we didn't use any of these like super sketchy growth hacking techniques, but I don't know, maybe we should have.
It was a point where it felt like this was going to be the new platform, the way that Windows had become a platform, the way that the browser became a platform for web apps. It seemed like Facebook was going to be the new app platform. You could almost imagine people using word processing apps on top of Facebook, because why wouldn't they? They'd want to have their friends participate in some of the writing with them. So I get Facebook's motivation, and I get the world that we were living in. What I'm not sure about is, what was your business model for this? How are you planning on charging, or was it going to be advertising?
Yeah, I mean, when we initially built it, it was just get as many users as possible and then monetize, probably through advertising, similar to how Facebook does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, eventually we saw that we weren't seeing the kind of growth that we wanted to. And actually, I think a big thing is like the user engagement, like the product just wasn't that sticky. Like people kind of use it once and then like go do something else. And so we started adding social features to it, and then ultimately realized that there was an opportunity to be a B2B company and sell the product to universities.
How did you realize that?
It's been a long time now, so I don't remember precisely. I think we had always looked at partnering with universities as a good growth channel, because once you have that partnership, you can use the university to drive adoption within their student body. And then I think through that, we said, okay, well, if we're partnering with them and we're giving them value, why don't we charge for the product and then we'll actually bring in revenue? And of course, revenue became particularly important in the financial crisis, because there weren't going to be any sources of funding. We had to really start making some cash.
I saw the press release about your eventual sale to a company called TargetX. They listed all the different things that you did. University's Schools app is a private online community for every institution's incoming class. Enrollment Intelligent is a premium feature for Schools app that uses real-time social behavioral data to predict admitted students' rank and probability to enroll. UChat is the only chat widget built mobile-first, prioritizing real-time student engagement. You were taking on a bunch.
Yeah.
You basically ended up creating a social network for each school, powered by and paid for by the school.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that was you guys learning to reach out to the universities and bring them in. And that wasn't your part. As the chief technical officer, you were developing the product.
Yeah, my main focus was running the engineering team, finding interesting technical opportunities. Like, you know, we built something very much like the Facebook news feed with content ranking and things like that. Surfacing things like people you were more likely to be friends with based on shared interests or activities.
Ah, so the incoming student would know, here are a few people I might want to get to know because they happen to have the same interests as I do.
Yeah, exactly.
I was trying to, before we got started, understand what you took away from this experience. And it seems to me like one thing you are especially proud of is you found a way to show universities that this would pay off for them financially, right? And by making that business case, you were able to come in and make the use case for the end user. You were able to bring them in. Mm-hmm. What was the business case that you made for universities?
The thing that universities care about is actually pretty similar to what other businesses care about. It's about user acquisition, which is like student acquisition, and user retention, which is like, you know, students staying at the school and completing.
Don't drop out and don't stop paying.
And so the product over time was, and you can see from some of the features, was pitched as a solution to this. It was at the top of funnel, you would bring your admitted students onto it before they had even accepted their offer. And we would match them with student activities and clubs and tell them about the school. And then also provide analytics to the university so that they actually could figure out which students to focus on to convince them to join. Once people were on the platform and they were attending the university, we'd help them build social connections, which are actually one of the biggest indicators of whether someone is likely to complete their degree or not, is whether they have the network of friends and support throughout their time there.
How did you know which students the university should focus on?
So it was ones that were most engaged in the platform oftentimes, or not engaged. So you could tell, okay, maybe someone is like on there every day, has made a ton of friends, you're all set. They're going to probably accept the offer and join the university.
Ah.
They might even like specifically click a button in the product that says, yeah, like I'm coming. Like,
got it. So the people who are gung-ho about the university are the ones who are trying to make friends, the ones who've maybe signaled that they're coming for sure. University doesn't need to spend time encouraging them. They're already as encouraged as they can be. Okay.
And in contrast, ones that didn't join the app or joined it but haven't had a high amount of activity, or who had a lot of activity but then haven't engaged recently, those are prospective students that an admissions counselor may want to reach out to and see how they're doing if they plan to attend.
That makes sense, right? If there's something that I want to buy, I might look at it. And then if I'm not that interested, I just stop. But the product creator doesn't know that I stopped looking at it on Amazon. They can't reach out to me.
Yeah.
Here, you enable them to do that. How big did you get the business?
So I left about 4 years in, and the company was acquired, I think, about 3 years after I left. So I don't know exactly how big they got. While I was there, it grew to about 30 people. Several million in ARR.
Here's at least from the press release, university's products have fostered over 3.9 million student connections, helping colleges provide more personal, engaging student experience. Why did you leave?
So it was a couple things. I think a big one was that I was ready to do something new and to take on like a new challenge where a lot of my technical interests would contribute. And the company had reached a stage where like we were continuing to build things, but it didn't feel like there was something where like my experience would be able to like add all that much more to the business. And yeah, looking to do something new, something a little bit more technical was also kind of something that was important to me.
Is it also, let's be open, is it because also you vested, you had as many shares you're going to get? Yes, you could get a little bit more, but that's like a job. You couldn't influence the direction of the company. So it's not like you had the CEO role and find ways to double and triple the company.
Yeah. It actually wasn't really tied to vesting. Like I was pretty satisfied with Mav Equity and you know, I had big ownership in the company. I think it did come down to not feeling like there was much like I could do to really influence the direction. And I was happy with the direction that my co-founders were taking the company, but I wanted something where I would have a greater influence, I guess.
How'd you do financially from that deal?
It was a small exit. The company like had raised like several rounds of funding. The growth rate was good, but it wasn't like world class. So in the end, fortunately, like made back a little bit, but
a couple hundred thousand?
It was like new car money, not new house money, I guess.
Okay. How'd you decide that you were going to get into games next?
Oh gosh. So the story there like took a lot of different turns. Yeah. I had been like just looking for something new to do. I looked at cybersecurity as a space. That was something I was really interested in. And then I was very interested in consumer products, in part because we had been building this B2B product that was kind of growing moderately on this social network, Facebook, that was consumer-centric and just grew explosively. So I really wanted to experience some of that. And so when I met my co-founder, he had a lot of experience in the consumer space. and we worked on a variety of ideas before ultimately settling on games.
Partially, it's because you like the idea of having a lot of people know what you're creating.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's always been really exciting for me is knowing that I've had a hand in building something that's being used or played by people all over the world. Mm-hmm. Games are an amazing way to do that.
All right, let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor. You know what? I told you I was going to tell you that you need to hire developers from them. I'm not going to push you to go hire developers. I'm actually going to give you something different that you could do with TopTown. You might have been reading in the news that a lot of these big companies have gotten really smart about getting government money, right? That they understand that we're heading into, if we're not in a recession and depression yet, we're heading into a really brutal financial situation. And so I don't begrudge them. And the fact that they understand how the rules are made and they understand how they should be operating to maximize the benefit for themselves, for their shareholders and their employees under the rules. I just don't want to be somebody who sits back and says, they've got all the smart people. We don't have access to them. They're going to win. We can't compete against them. One of the things that I did, and I've talked about this before, is a few years ago, I went to TopTal and I said, do you have a business consultant? And they introduced me to somebody who used to work at McKinsey and a lot of major organizations like that. And I said, sure, here he is. Here's Jack. Interview him. Jack was one of five people that I interviewed. I really clicked with Jack. I started working with him as somebody who would give me insight into how I could fix my profits. We were making so much revenue because you can hear my interviews. I'm obsessed with revenue, but profits weren't jumping. At times it was getting really dangerous there where we were losing money for some months. I go, what is going on here? And Jack and I went through and we figured out all the little places where I was being wasteful or not thinking as strongly as I could. And one of the things that I discovered was Jack was helping the people who were writing all the rules post-COVID. It wasn't that I hired him for that. It's just that people who are smart like him just get invited into the room by senators. And he's given me insight into who he's talking to. He's shown me the notes from conversations and I understand. And I basically think, great, I'm not going to get the details, but Jack, you are. And so I've gone to him and I said, what can I do PPP wise? Here's how the law's written. Here's how the rules are written. He started explaining to me. And if I had any questions, if I didn't know how to maximize my ability to, this is probably not the best way to say what I'm saying. I want to take advantage of as much as I can because in the right way, because I don't know how bad this environment is going to be. And so I reached out to Jack and he was able to help me out tremendously over the last 6 months as the economy got worse and worse. All that to say, if you're out there listening to me and you need somebody to give you some business advice, I'm not talking about like the guru self-help business advice. I'm talking about somebody who's been at McKinsey, who's been in organizations and been the person to get the unfair advantage for those bigger organizations. If you need it for yourself, go to TopTal. They'll help you hire somebody to do that, help you hire somebody to help you raise money, help you put together spreadsheets, presentations, all the stuff that we consider these MBA types good for, but we may not have them on staff. You can hire them part-time, full-time, project-wise, whatever you need from TopTal. All you have to do is go to top as in top of your head, tal as in talent. That's toptal.com/mixergy. And when you go to that URL, you'll see they've got an exclusive offer that will give you plenty of time and a lot of confidence in why you should be hiring from them. All you have to do is go to toptal.com/mixergy, toptal.com/mixergy. All right. You launched it. The company was called Hiptic. Why is it called Hiptic?
Oh, I don't even remember, actually. I think we just looked down a list of names and that one sounded good.
There was a good .com available for it. So you got Hiptic.com and you created games. And one of the games that you created was Go Ninja. What was Go Ninja?
Yeah, Go Ninja was, it started as an experiment and a test for ourselves of whether we could build a fun game in a very short period of time. And the game was a 2D side scroller where you were a ninja and kind of running through buildings, jumping up and down rooftops and things like that, and slashing all the mutant zombies that stood in your way. It's actually kind of a play on Fruit Ninja, because Fruit Ninja is, of course, a very cute game where you're like slicing fruit. Our opinion was that ninjas don't slice fruit. Like,
did you get what you were hoping for? Did you see friends use this and play this game? Did you get to experience that?
Oh, yeah.
You did.
Yeah, the game was a huge hit.
How'd you know it was a huge hit beyond the numbers? What did you see?
Just people's response to it. The game, we built it very quickly. And we got the first version released in a month, which was a challenge. The game was very visually polished. It had some pretty complex game mechanics. But yeah, Apple featured it right away. So the editors definitely saw that the game was going to be popular. And then we saw that the game actually had a pretty high viral coefficient. So people that would download it were quite likely to tell their friends about it. So even though we never spent money on marketing or ads, millions of people downloaded the game organically.
And so if you could create that, why did you struggle to get alerts, to get notifications on people's phones?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is there were all these tools that we had been using to build Go Ninja and some of our later games. So lots of good tools out there for building the game, designing it, doing all the artwork, lots of resources for sound effects and music, and also lots of things when it came to monetization, like many ad networks and places to run ads if we need to do that.
So you're not putting... I always imagine when you're creating a game, at least back then, that you were creating everything from scratch. Maybe you're getting sound effects, but I thought designing all the artwork yourself. And you're saying, no, Andrew, we didn't need to do all that. You could pick up some Lego pieces, some aspects of the game, like Lego pieces, and put them together.
Well, sure. I mean, like, we did do the sound effects ourselves, but of course, there was great software to help us do that. And we used the game engine at the top. For that game, we used the game engine. It's kind of funny, the name now, but it was called Corona SDK.
Okay.
they've since renamed it, which is smart. But it made a lot of this easy, right? We can just kind of load the sound effects in and it would handle them well. It could handle different formats.
It's called Solar, right? Solar 2D, I think.
So, yeah, I mean, it was a great... It definitely sped up the process of creating the game. And it also was cross-platform, so we didn't have to build it for iOS and Android. We just had one code base.
Okay. All right. And so you built it, but there was no way to create notifications unless you did it yourself?
Yeah, basically. There were some vendors out there that would help. So I think one of the early companies to be in this market was Urban Airship. They've since renamed themselves to just Airship. And they were kind of a go-to in the early days for most developers, but they had moved to be a very enterprise-centric company, and so the pricing was just completely out of reach for us. And in fact, I don't think they even had an SDK for Corona, nor anything that would even like make it easy to integrate and use. And so this was true for, you know, that was the first game, but we built several after that, and this just kept being a problem. It was like, how do we just send notifications? Like, it's free, technically free. Like, people have given us permission to send notifications. It's very effective, yet somehow there's neither a suitable open source tool nor an affordable and good commercial tool to do this. And yeah, I mean, that really surprised us.
So you decided we're going to go and create this ourselves. Was it going to be a project for yourselves or something that you thought other developers would use?
Yeah, at the very early version of it, it was just like, we need to build a thing for ourselves. Let's see what open source things we can build on top of. But very quickly, as we talked to other developers, other game developers, and small businesses, we realized that this was actually a pretty promising business opportunity.
And by other developers, you mean your friends, right? Who are creating this? Or was there something more formal than that?
Yeah, it was friends mainly.
Okay. So you're reaching out, you're seeing that this is an opportunity, but still now you're going to get pulled back into B2B. Why was that okay for you?
Well, B2B was, there are a couple things that made it still pretty exciting. The first is that we intentionally wanted to take the approach of not building a product that would just focus on a small number of enterprise clients. When we looked at this, we said this is something that every single developer in the world will want to use. And so while it's, sure, it's other businesses, the impact that it has and the number of people using it would be, you know, it has now, you know, effectively reached consumer scale. And the other one is that it really appealed to my own passions as a developer and wanting to help people like myself.
Plus, when you're talking about developers, it's almost like consumers. You could be really proud to see that your favorite developer is using your push notification. You could start to see the tech community that you love, that you're a part of, use it and get excited about it and feel that sense of pride that you get from watching strangers play your game. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then it was actually really fun to have early support conversations with people trying out the product because, it was just like talking to someone like myself who was really like having a much better experience as a result of finding our solution.
You know, I remember around the time that you started, there was a company called Notifo that failed. They wanted to do the same thing as you did. And I interviewed the founder around the time that you started about why the company failed. And I don't remember the details of it. Why do you think that that company failed? Why do you think that this didn't exist before?
Yeah, so there's a lot of reasons why doing this is really hard. And actually, one of the things that has been interesting in our space is if you look at the competitive landscape, the vast majority of the companies providing products like ours are very, very enterprise-centric. And actually, one of the biggest reasons for that is that providing this technology is hard. Like, the technical hurdles that you have to cross are very difficult. The difficulty of setting up and being successful with a product like this can be quite difficult. And I think most people believe that if you build this for everyone, that like they just won't be able to figure it out, or you'll have to provide them too much support, or it'll cost too much to provide it. And so I think a lot of companies have like either realized that and moved, or they haven't realized that and like had a lot of trouble and failed as a result. But we found a way to really nail it. Like, there's a couple of things that we've done differently in our business that have helped us scale as a broad.
Like what?
Yeah, so a few things. One is being fanatical about keeping our infrastructure costs low. So we're a freemium product that provides a piece of infrastructure to our customers, which means we have to make sure to provide that in a way that's affordable to us. So we can now provide, we provide to almost 1 million developers now for free, as an example. We host everything on bare metal, so that improves our margin. We are very careful about how we build stuff so it doesn't use too much computation or storage.
Can you give me an example of something you do to keep your costs low?
I mean, the bare metal part is a big part of it. So a lot of people will build on AWS and they'll use a lot of the AWS managed services, which make it really easy to build powerful features, but you pay a fortune for them. So if you're using Amazon's hosted database or a lot of the tools that they offer, your hosting costs are going to be much, much higher than if you essentially run it yourself.
What's bare metal?
Yeah, so bare metal means a server that's not running a virtualization layer. And it's also not, it doesn't have any other companies using it. So a lot of times when you spin up an Amazon server, that's a piece of hardware that is being used by four or five different companies, depending on the size of the server that you provision. With bare metal, it's just like having a computer in your room or in your closet. You have complete control over it. You're the only tenant on it. There's no virtualization layer, which means you get even higher performance. And then the other thing that we've done and kind of tied to that is we actually have control over the hardware that we get. So we customize the hardware that's put into our servers so that we're not paying for things we don't use, and we are optimizing our costs for the specific hardware components that we really benefit from.
I guess I would have thought that it would be more expensive to do that because you have to run so much more yourself.
It does create additional overhead because you're having to, there's certain services that you have to run yourself instead of just using a managed service. It can also introduce like a little bit of an operations burden. Like, you have to have engineers that are experienced at running systems like this, and that's a more rare skill these days. But when you're operating at scale and like infrastructure costs are a focus, this is definitely a very efficient way to do it.
By the way, are you playing with the pen?
No, let me put that away.
Oh, I thought I heard clicking. What were you?
I was, yeah, sorry.
So many entrepreneurs who do that. Do you do that all day long as you're sitting there, you're kind of clicking away? For me, there are a few different things that I use. Sometimes I'll spin the iPad pencil. I feel like almost it's there just to give me something to play with. I can't sit still. I struggle with it.
Yeah, I've got the same thing.
No, the thing that I wonder, George, as we talk about this is, Apple makes so many things so easy. Why aren't they making notifications so easy? Why is it such a difficult aspect of so many businesses' world?
Well,
what makes it hard?
There's a couple things. You know, Apple makes it surprisingly hard, to be honest. Like, the protocol in order to send the user a message is quite complicated. You actually have to make a separate HTTP API call for every user that you want to send a message to.
Okay.
And if you have a game like we have with GoNinja, you have millions of users. So that means you need to make millions of API calls, and building that is pretty annoying if most of the time you just want to build your game instead.
Okay.
But then that's just, you know, sort of the base layer of it. But on top of that, you actually want to do more than send notifications. You want to send them to a relevant audience, or you want to translate them into each user's local language, or you want to schedule it at the right point of time. And so you're not just building something to deliver notifications, you're building a marketing platform. And that's not something that Apple ever really cares to do.
That makes sense, right? I might want a notification during the day, but not at 7 a.m.
Right.
And you're analyzing, were you thinking even back then, how do we analyze each user's experience when they happen to be on the game, what time zone they're in? You wanted to do all that.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the first features we built, actually.
All right, let me talk about my second sponsor and then get back into what the reaction was, how you're going to make money, and then how you went beyond these iOS notifications. Was it iOS and Android from the very beginning?
Those are the first two. Yeah.
First two. All right. So my second sponsor is a company called HostGator. I should tell everyone who's listening to me, if you like the idea of notifications that bring people back into apps, you should understand the OneSignal also enables you to do that on the browser. Do you have an example of a company that's done that really well with WordPress? WordPress is one of the things that HostGator is especially good at. What's an example of something you...
Let's see if I can think of a WordPress one. I'm not sure if this is a WordPress site, but you know, an example would be our client, Business Insider, sends web push notifications and they're super effective.
Yeah. Every time that... It could be anytime they have a post or anytime they have a really good post. And could they do if-then analysis also using OneSignal? So instead of sending it to everybody as soon as the post is published, send it to people based on something?
Yeah, absolutely. Or actually, sometimes what we'll see people do is they'll publish two articles and they'll A-B test which one gets more clicks, and then they'll send notification for the more interesting one.
And they'll do it within OneSignal. They'll take a small batch of people, send them a notification based on the headline, see what people click on, and then they have a winner and they change the headline, and then everybody gets the notification with the winning headline, and all the future web browsers who find them on Google get the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we have some support for multivariate testing.
One of the reasons why I knew you guys were super effective was I happened to go down a rabbit hole of conversations with direct marketers, online marketers. And they were talking about how they were telling all their people to go and sign up for OneSignal because it's free, because it just works, because it brings people right back, because you guys don't stuff all kinds of nonsense in the alerts. It's not like 9 alerts for Andrew's site and then the 10th alert is for your sponsor, right? You guys don't do that.
No.
So it just works really well. All right. And where was it? I was even on I'm on WordPress.org. There's a one-click install of your plugin that has high ratings, looks like over 100,000 active installations. Where's the ratings? Strong ratings, people love it, and it makes it really easy to install this on any WordPress website. That means that even if does the browser even have to be open for OneSignal alert to come up?
In most cases, well, it depends. One of the big places where alerts are used are on Android devices. So you can visit a website on your Android device and get notifications without having to install an app.
Wow,
the browser does not have to be open. Most of the time on desktop, the browser has to be open, but you don't have to be on that website. So you could be doing something else on the web.
You get a notification that says there's a new post or a new offer or a new discount, right? Hit the link, boom, go over. Listen to me, if you're out there and you haven't created a website yet, WordPress is an easy way to get started. All you have to do is go to hostgator.com/mixergy and you could get started with WordPress. And yes, they have lots of other platforms you can use, but WordPress is super easy. And I like how portable it is. If you're not happy with this hosting company, I think you will be, you could pick up and move. But with HostGator, you get super low price, dependable service that will scale up with you. We switched to HostGator a while back and nobody noticed. The site's not down. We're not dealing with any headaches. It just freaking works. So go to hostgator.com/mixergy, get started today. If you're not happy with your hosting company, switch to HostGator, save yourself some money, and understand that they have the cheapest price available on hostgator.com/mixergy. But as your needs develop and you decide that you want more than what they have on there, they will scale with you. They have things like managed WordPress hosting, they'll give you a dedicated server, all that stuff, also at a really low price because, frankly, they're a leader in this. They've got so many resources to bring in that they could reduce their costs. All right, hostgator.com/mixergy, super low price. If you use that /mixergy, great service that will just work. And if it ever doesn't work for you, I'm andrew@mixergy.com. Let me know. And I'm at 201 Mission Street in San Francisco. Let me know. I always want to make sure that I bring good sponsors who will especially take good care of my audience. hostgator.com/mixergy. All right, how are you planning on making money if you were offering this for free?
Well, actually, when we first released it, the business model was to continue giving it out for free and to monetize similar to an ad network once we had enough market reach.
Meaning that if it would be that thing that I suggested earlier, where it might be something like nine links back to the site owner who got the installation, and then the 10 would be for a sponsor?
No, not exactly.
Tell me, what was it?
Yeah, one of the things we had looked at as an example was a company, you may remember them, it was called Flurry Analytics. Mm-hmm. And what Flurry Analytics had done is they provided a free analytics tool, and they used the data they got from the analytics that all these publishers were providing them to users to create a more personalized ad network. And so that was actually the model that we went with initially as well.
Oh, so you would have your own ad network completely different from these alerts. The ads wouldn't show up in the alerts that you served up. It would just be, we understand the audience better. We understand where you should go. Got it.
Right.
Wow. Why did you decide to do that instead of going freemium? That's competing with Google and Facebook.
You know, I think coming from the mindset of developers, we really, really liked free products. I mean, just developers love free stuff. And the prospect of being able to do that, to offer such a powerful product for free and to, you know, both be able to provide notifications to help people increase retention, but also then to be able to provide a really good monetization mechanism, felt like a win all for everyone involved.
Yeah. And you had so many features already built into the first version and no advertising. Did you ever get into the advertising part of it?
In a sense, yes. So yeah, while we never built an ad network, we did work with advertising partners who were licensing some of the data that we were generating in the early days of the company.
You had A/B test for messaging. You had real-time tracking. You had segmentation targeting. This is in the first or early versions, right?
Early versions, yeah.
How'd you know what to put in?
It was just the stuff that we wished we had had ourselves when we were building games.
Totally building for yourself, the way that the Basecamp people keep preaching. Don't try to do market research, just create something for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, that really helped early on. But actually, the next kind of thing that happened, like the very first version was just built on our own intuition. But then we became very, very customer driven. So we had live chat on our website with our customers. And as soon as we got a request that was reasonable, we would put that to the top of our priority list, build it and try to convince that customer to integrate the product.
I think because I'm not a mobile app developer, I always knew you guys as the browser alerts people. When did you get into that?
So WebPush was a really fortunate channel for us. It was something that had got announced very soon after we released the mobile version of our product. And we knew that it would be both a really big channel because nobody had been using this before and a lot of traffic still goes to websites, whether that's on desktop or on a mobile device. It's also a channel that nobody else had built for yet. So it was not like a greenfield opportunity to support this amazingly popular new channel. And a lot of what we had already built carried over to it because desktop notifications, web push notifications are actually very similar to mobile in a lot of ways. And yeah, that led us to doing it very quickly.
How did you get more customers beyond the first friends who knew you or more users? How did you get them?
So a couple things. Word of mouth has actually been one of the largest drivers that we have. People just love telling, like as soon as they integrate our plugin, I think they really like telling their friends about the experience and the value that we provide, especially while it was free. I think that built a lot of really goodwill and curiosity about the product. The other big channel for us, especially these days, is the quality of our documentation. So many people have questions around how to implement notifications or how to use them better. And they're always landing on our docs because we've spent so much time writing about it.
I'm noticing that that's a huge reason why developers integrate software. If the documentation is good, they're more likely to work with it.
Oh, yeah.
Did you also get one signal, like branding on the alerts? I think you did, right?
We actually have decided never to do that. So one of the things that you can do when you're prompting for web notifications is you can put branding on them, and a lot of other like smaller competitors in the space do that. Our thought is even that for free clients, it's a pretty bad user experience to put our branding on their website. And so we've never done it.
Really? And then did you do anything else to court developers?
Basically what I covered, documentation obviously ties into SEO, so that helps us, and then word of mouth.
Wow. And no push with developers, no organizing events, no educational webinars, nothing like that?
Yeah, we do webinars now. Actually, I'd say the webinars are most helpful for like existing customers or those like evaluating the product more than they are like bringing in someone who's never heard about us. We haven't done events yet. It's something that we'd like to do, you know, either virtually or maybe in person after COVID. But there's just been too many other things to do for now.
Yeah, good luck with that. Yeah. Feels like there's not enough of an upside for doing it now, right?
Yeah, could be a while.
What about on the other side? How did you end up getting one of the things that you do is you aggregate data, right, on usage, and you sell that to third parties?
Well, not anymore. That was our business model when we started the company and in the first couple of years. But no, actually, about 18 months ago or so, we switched to being just a SaaS business. We stopped sharing any data with any of our customers on that side.
Wow. So I guess it was a couple of years ago, I sent an email in and I got a response, and then you responded afterwards. You said, Andrew, I recognize the domain. I recognize you. You said a lot of really nice things. And then you said, I'll be open with you. We do aggregate our data and sell it. And then I followed up and said, what about individual data? You said, I'll be open with you. We don't do that now, but we have the right to do it within our terms of service. We might at some point in the future. And I just respected the hell out of that response. Yep. And then you're saying you didn't do any of it. You don't do any of it. You never did any targeting based on my individual site or selling my individual data, and you don't do any aggregation sales either.
Yeah, not anymore. And we never did it for web push. It was something that we had experimented with, but ultimately like never did on that side. We did work with some partners on the mobile side, but not anymore.
So now it's all freemium. Mm-hmm. A lot of people using it for free, some of them paying for the enterprise version.
Yeah.
Post-COVID, how have you seen usage change?
It's been really interesting, actually. We weren't sure what to expect, but very quickly, two big things happened. The first is that the number of notifications that our customers are sending per day, all added together, went up about 25%. And it's actually stayed about that level. It's dropped down a little bit, but it's now much higher than it was before. The other is for the first couple weeks of COVID in particular, the number of people signing up for OneSignal went up about 25 or 30% as well. So the number of just top of funnel people adding OneSignal and setting it up grew a ton.
I noticed that from my interviews that a lot of entrepreneurs were seeing that if they were catering to website owners, they were getting more usage because people were stuck at home. They weren't sure about their futures. They decided that if this was a side gig, they better start taking care of their side gig website and improving it. And they had time to do it. So they were focused on it. Is that still true? Or are you seeing that the numbers went back to pre-COVID levels?
The numbers are down a little bit from their like all-time high, but still much higher than pre-COVID.
Because still a lot of people are at home, still a lot of people have time now to fix their online businesses. Is that it?
I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is, so one interesting part about our platform is we're not just US-centric. Like I think at the start of COVID, all countries were very highly impacted. And now I think it's more just a smaller number of countries. Mm-hmm. Yet across the globe, even in countries that have since like ended sort of lockdown or most restrictions, we continue to see like high adoption and high usage. So I actually think that there has been a shift in people's mindset and knowledge to be more focused on promoting their business online than there was before COVID.
You know, Scott Galloway said, everything that we thought was going to happen over 10 years to online businesses, just it's going to happen, but it's going to be compressed now to 1 year. And so we always knew retail was going to be dead. Or suffer dramatically. It's just all happening now. 10 years worth of suffering dramatically happening in 1 year, which is way more dramatic. And so that's what's happening. People are much more willing to buy groceries online. I always thought everyone bought groceries online. Why would you go in a store? It turns out a lot of people, most people by far go into stores. Right. And now they're willing to consider online. And same thing for a lot of online businesses. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you look at this. Your pricing is completely different. When you guys switched, I'm imagining you you made more money when you decided to switch to freemium than you did before when you were selling data, right?
Yeah. Both we grew revenue quite quickly when we made the switch, and actually a lot faster than we even expected. We thought that a lot of our users would just say, if it's not free, I'm not going to use it. See ya. But in fact, it wasn't like that at all. A very few users were upset. Many of them were enthusiastic. A lot of them converted to being some of our biggest paid customers today.
Why? They weren't seeing any problems with the free version, right? It's not like you were selling their individual data. What did they care if you were selling aggregate data? They didn't seem to care, right? They were using you. Why were they suddenly happy to pay you?
You know, I think it's a few things. I think there were definitely customers that cared, or where it was just a question mark in their mind. Like, maybe they didn't really understand it. Like, do I need to worry about this? I think another part of it is they wanted to know that we were a business that was going to like have a business model they understood and be able to support them for a long time.
Right.
And while our free model was working in many ways from that standpoint, I think people didn't necessarily believe it. And so they didn't necessarily trust the longevity of our business with that model.
You know, that makes sense. I'm looking at the email. I thought we just exchanged emails 2 years ago. This was 4 years ago that we exchanged these emails, almost exactly 4 years ago. And that was my hesitation at the time. I wasn't worried about you selling my personal website data. I knew that I would be able to pull out if you were. I just thought, well, you told me that there's a way to pay you if I want to switch to an enterprise version, but I couldn't figure out where that was. It wasn't on your website. It doesn't seem like it was a major part of your business. Am I going to get pushback from my audience because some of them are worried about where the data is going? And then I thought, I can't take my users away from you. If we're talking about web browser alerts, right? It's not like I can say, I'm taking all my permissions with me and going to your competitor, right?
Yeah, switching is pretty painful.
Which is great for lock-in. Do you see a lot of churn?
The main churn we see is just because we have a lot of small businesses using the product. And so they tend to be more price sensitive or more likely to go out of business. But churn to competitors is really low. I think we have by far the best product in the space, and that creates a lot of stickiness.
Yeah, we're looking at $99 a month if somebody has, what is it? Oh, no. I see. It actually starts to scale up based on the number of subscribers. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to prune subscribers?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, you can delete subscribers anytime.
So if they're not active, I can just get rid of them.
Yeah. Most of the time, you probably don't want to. Like, even inactive users are ones that you have the opportunity to reactivate. But if cost is a concern, or if you know that those users aren't interesting, you can prune them.
Where do you get the majority of your revenue from, the browser alerts or from app alerts?
It's about evenly split.
And then there's browser, there's app. You guys also do email alerts. Mm-hmm. I have to collect email addresses for that. I'm imagining that's a smaller part of your business, right?
It is for now. It's actually something that we're putting more and more attention towards because we're starting to see more of our customers, especially as customers start to pay us and some of them get bigger. They love our system so much for notifications. They want to use it for email as well. And in-app messaging has actually been a very popular channel for us that we introduced recently.
That's the alerts that come on within the app, not when I'm away from the app to remind me to use it, but when I'm in the app. I get that a lot more now from Spotify. They'll alert me, I'd say an average of twice a week with an ad or message about a new podcast. I don't know if it's a paid ad or what, but here's a new podcast. Hit this button to subscribe.
Yeah. Yeah. It works super well because it lets a company present new timely content to their users that can be designed by like their marketing team or product team, so developers don't have to build it. And also they don't have to ship a new app version. So it's a really good channel.
What do you mean they don't have to ship a new app version? Because as long as they have your SDK in their software, they could just send out a new offer without having to update the app in order to get the offer in.
Yeah. So for example, one of the things that happened around the Black Lives Matter movement recently in the protests is a lot of companies wanted to share their support for this. And so we saw a bunch of clients actually use in-app messaging to voice their support for Black Lives Matter and to share links towards resources and places to donate money. And they were able to just turn this on overnight without having to like ship a new version of the app with like some new page. They could just use an in-app message.
So I understand the use for website owners, for app makers, What about for end users? Isn't it annoying that you can go to any website and they could flash an alert that says, do you want to get an alert to be reminded to come back here? And there's no way to get rid of it.
Oh, I mean, there's totally ways to get rid of it. But actually, one of the, like, we agree, it's like super annoying when you get to a website without context, you're asked if you want to get messages from it.
And it stops everything else, depending on the browser. You could possibly not be able to do anything else. It's like those old iOS alerts. You should get our app instead of using our website. And in the end, Apple finally said, tell you what, we'll give you an alert at the top of your site. It's not going to interrupt the user's experience and they could always exit out. Right? With these alerts, it takes over the interaction with the website. It doesn't take over the whole page, but you can't do anything unless you X out or say, okay.
Yeah. So there's a couple things that we've been doing to improve that experience, but also that the browser vendor has done. So for us, we actually provide a built-in way for customers to create a prompt that has customized context for why you should allow them. And by default, we tell our customers, don't prompt on the first visit, prompt after the user has either specifically clicked a button that says, I want notifications, and we give you the HTML for the button, or after they've had a certain amount of engagement, like visits, number of visits or visit duration. So we have a bunch of stuff we've done there. You've probably seen a little bell icon that some websites use. That's another way that
in the bottom right, I think.
Yeah, it can be customized. The color can be customized. But then the other thing that's happening is browser vendors have seen notifications abused or been used to trick users. And so the latest version of Chrome, version 84, if websites are using notifications in an abusive way, or if they keep showing the native prompt and the deny rate is extremely high, that website will actually get penalized and will not be able to ask for notifications until they resolve the problem.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, let me ask you one other question that I probably should have asked earlier. When you made the switch over, you took people who had unlimited free and you told them, now you have to pay, right? How was that? I didn't think of those people.
Yeah, it was a very interesting plan we had to put in place, because actually we didn't want to alienate all our users and cause a bunch of anger and frustration. We also recognized that offering a really good free service was an insane source of leads for us. Like, the reason we have a million developers now is because many of them came to us wanting to start for free. So what we did is we picked gates that would affect a smaller number of users and the ones that were clearly getting value higher than our cost. And we still stay very, very generous. So to this day, and looking towards the future, we will always offer unlimited mobile subscribers and unlimited mobile notifications for free.
Mobile apps or mobile Chrome?
Users, yeah.
Okay.
On web, we did put in a limit of 30,000, but that's quite high, and you can prune your subscribers. And then it is pretty affordable going up beyond that. And so that turned out to be a very good kind of place to put the feature gating. And then the newer features that we're building almost all of them include a free component. So in-app messaging, you can create one for free. And if you want more than one, you either have to turn that one off or you can switch to a paid plan.
Got it. And so it feels like it's the features largely that, well, if I'm understanding you right, you're saying, Andrew, the majority of our people who are free fell below the threshold. It seems like you're also willing to work with some of the ones who weren't. Right? And make some exceptions, but it wasn't that much of a deal?
Yeah. I mean, there were definitely for any customers that are really big, we don't, like, our pricing doesn't scale linearly. Like, they can talk to us and we'll give them a pricing plan where they have a volume discount. And for customers that were particularly squeezed by some of the payment gates that we put in place, which was a very small number total, we did work with them to give them pricing options that made it affordable.
And then a lot of the new features, you give a little bit to the free people, a lot more to the paid, or you give none to the free people, right? Like time trigger notifications, that's just for the paid plans.
Yeah, it depends. So our thought process is, if we believe that in order to understand the value of a paid feature, someone has to try out a free version, then we'll always do it that way. If it's obvious, time trigger notifications, through our documentation and just sort of looking at it, you understand what it does, and then that's paid only.
All right, let me close out with this. I heard in the last round of funding that you did that you were able to take a little money off the table for yourself, that after all these years, you finally were able to put a little bit aside in the bank for yourself. Is that true?
No comment on that.
Okay. All right. What's the best part of having done all this?
Yeah, let's see. I think just seeing the scale that the company is at this point is really quite remarkable. Like the number of customers that we serve, the number of notifications that we send. It's cool to just see the stats and know that everything we're building has such a big impact for people around the world.
And the response rate is huge on these things, right? You send an alert. People are, what's the response rate on average for a web alert?
It totally varies depending on the customer. You know, if it's like a social networking app and you get a message from a friend, like it's going to be like 80% plus. Mm-hmm. If it's something that's more of like a marketing message, it might only be like 1 or 2%. But all in all, when you compare it to any other channel, if you compare it to email, for example, it's like 10x higher or more.
You know, we should probably reactivate this. We had it up on our site for a while, and then I switched to Facebook Messenger as an obsession. And so I decided to take it off just to focus on Messenger and never put it back on. But we should do that again. I remember we would have high response rates, and I wouldn't send a message out every time I had a new interview, but every time I had a new interview that was especially popular, I would send a notification out. People would come to the site, they would download it, and it would get definitely the higher response that we were hoping for.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, perfect for a blog like yours.
George, thanks so much for being on here and for being a supporter of Mixergy. You were a premium member, you were a listener, somebody who went out there and you built a site, and I appreciate you coming in and doing this interview. My schedule has been a little bit unpredictable over COVID because I'm trying to figure out when I could get recording time, when school will be open, when I'll have time to myself. And I sent you a message yesterday and I was so happy when you said, yes, Andrew, I will do it, even though I've got less than 24 hours notice. Thanks for coming on here.
Yeah, it's been great.
The website for everyone else is, everyone who doesn't know it, it's just onesignal.com. And of course, if you're in WordPress, it's built into your WordPress app. So go into the plugin section and get it. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first will actually help you get a WordPress website built fast. And I know it's fast because I tested it just recently. I created a website for somebody. It took me less than 30 minutes to do the whole thing. The toughest part was I kept futzing around with the freaking themes instead of saying, just freaking launch, Andrew, move on. Stop trying to get the best perfect design. And then that freed me to get started. And that is hostgator.com/Mixergy to get the special price from them. And if you're hiring a developer, you know to go to TopTal. You should also know if you need a top level MBA to come in and help you think through your business strategy, especially now during these, what is it that everyone says in the top of their email? These unprecedented times. Especially now in these unprecedented times. Really, go to toptal.com/Mixergy. Thanks so much for doing this. Bye, everyone.